Blog Talk Radio.
This is Movie Geeks United. How's everyone out there doing tonight? This is one of your co-hosts for the evening. My name is Jamie, and introduce yourself, Guy.
Hey, it's Jerry. How's everyone doing tonight?
My trusted fellow co-host, my co-conspirator for the evening.
Your co-conspirator, there you go.
We have a nice show for you tonight. We have a couple of great guests. So I just want to let everyone know at the top, if you have any questions for the guests or the Movie Geeks, you can give us a call at 718-508-9477. You can also log on to our chat room and converse with other film fans, and Jerry is in there too, about whatever you'd like, with something that's happening on the show or not, something
anything
else that's on your
about.
Mind. It's really a space, a nice space there for confession.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And Jerry will be your...
I will be your priest.
That's right. So how's everything been this week for you, Jerry?
Everything's been all right. Very quiet week. How about you?
Pretty good. I've got the whole cold thing still going on in my voice.
Oh yeah, I hated that. It seems to be everyone I know has it now. So
yeah, I mean, I just got over being really sick last week, but it's still lingering in my voice. So I sound very Nicholson-esque. don't you find that quality in my voice?
Yeah, definitely.
Listen to this.
Mr. Nicholson.
Yeah, listen to this. Where'd you learn to talk like that? In some Panama City sailor want a hump bar?
That's very good.
Thank you.
Very good. All right.
So we're waiting for our first guest to call tonight. Let me tell you about some of the guests we have upcoming. We have a very exciting lineup that's growing by the day. It seems like every day I'm calling you, Jerry, to say, hey, we got this guy. Some exciting stuff going on. This Sunday, we have a big show. We have, confirmed right now, we have Seth Gordon and Ed Cunningham. That is the director and the producer of the recent documentary King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters.
One of the greats.
It is one of the great documentaries. You're no doubt about it. You're right, my friend. And it's such a, you know, it's about two very appealing and strong personalities who are vying for the world record in Donkey Kong. Which automatically, when I read that, I thought, man, that sounds really interesting. That sounds like a lot of fun. But the drama of seeing these two strong characters, you know, and it's reality.
Absolutely. I mean,
you can't make this stuff up. These strong characters going head to head, it really, like, it's very intense and very human. It's a great, great movie. One of the most enjoyable documentaries I think I've seen in a long, long time.
Exactly.
It's so impressive. It premiered at Sundance last year.
Was it Sundance or was it Slam Dance? I forget which.
I think it was the big hit of Sundance.
Okay, all right.
And I think it so impressed people that they were hired to do a feature film adaptation of it. And also that director Seth Gordon, he's in the big time now. He's now directing a movie called Four Christmases. He's currently in production.
Oh yes, Vince Vaughn and Reese Witherspoon. Yes.
Yeah, a big movie. John Favreau's in it too. Like anything that Vince Vaughn's in, John Favreau stops by. it's like Rob Schneider following Adam Sandler all over the place. That's not fair. That's not fair because they're all extremely talented people in their own right.
They are.
But big movie career he has now. He'll be joining us Sunday to talk about or the documentary that is now available on DVD shelves, his current movie, Four Christmases, and plans for the feature film adaptation. But that's not all. That's only the first half hour of Sunday's show. The second half hour, we're going to be welcoming David Auburn, and he is a Pulitzer Prize-winning and Tony Award-winning playwright. He wrote the play Proof. He also wrote the screenplay adaptation of it. His new film he wrote and directed is called The Girl in the Park, and it stars Sigourney Weaver and Kate Bosworth, a couple other fantastic people. So we can't wait to welcome him on as well. Next Wednesday, we have a really interesting show. We have you heard of this movie, Shine a Light, Jerry?
I know. Yeah, it'd be the closest I come probably to seeing the Rolling Stones ever again. So.
Yeah, and seeing them the way you want to see them, because this is a concert/documentary film on the Stones, directed by none other than Martin Scorsese. You just know from how he's used Stones music in his past films.
Oh, yeah, and it's a great trailer. I always like watching the trailer. So yeah,
it is great. And what's particularly appealing about this movie is it is shot by I think 10 of our top cinematographers. I mean, we're talking about Roger Elswit. I think Deakins is in there, too.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I think you're right.
Stuart Dreiberg, some of our great photographers. One of those cinematographers, Anastas Nikos, and I'll get the pronunciation right if that's incorrect, by Wednesday. He's on the film as well, and he also just photographed the new movie called The Women. You know, the big female cast.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, it's a big movie. A lot of high-profile female talent in that film. So he'll have a lot to talk about on Wednesday night, and then we'll be welcoming Oscar-nominated composer Marco Beltrami. He's nominated this year for his inventive score to 310 to Yuma. So we have an Oscar nominee. We're welcoming a Pulitzer Prize winner and an Oscar nominee. And then the following Sunday, I think this is the 17th, we're welcoming a legend and someone who's won multiple Oscars and been nominated multiple times, Bo Goldman. He is one of our great screenwriters. Melvin and Howard, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, City
Hall.
You don't
need to do anything else after that. I mean,
Sensible Woman. I mean, on and on and on.
Yeah,
that's a great talent right there. We're so honored to welcome him on our show next Sunday. So that's our lineup as it stands right now. We're going to replay later on the show. We're going to replay an interview that we did with director Joseph Greco and star Joe Pantoliano, Joey Pants, where they're talking about their film Canvas, which is a great little film that just was released on DVD last week, and we want to get the word out and expose it to as many people as possible. So we're going to replay that interview near the end of the show, more than likely. We're waiting for our first guest to call, but in the meantime, Jerry, what's new in movies? What do you want to talk about tonight?
Well, the lineup for the Southwest Film Festival in Austin has been posted on Ain't It Cool News, and there's some interesting films there. And, you know, they also, what I like about that festival is they also have a lot of bands, a lot of music, live music as well. And I'm just looking through the lineup. Like you say, Shine a Light is going to be there.
It will have its world premiere there, yeah.
Yeah. Also, Choke from Set was also premiered at Sundance is going to be there.
Right. What have you heard about Choke?
It's going to come out in August. You know, I read the book a long time ago. It's a great book by the same gentleman who wrote Fight Club. And I've heard good things about it. I haven't, like, not overtly enthusiastic, but I've heard good enough things that it sounds like it's got, I believe, Sam Rockwell's in it. And I think it will be one to check out. I'm looking forward to it. I won't lie to you. I'm there opening day. Also, Stop Loss. Is going to be there by Kimberly Pierce. This is the first film I believe she's directed since Boys Don't Cry.
Stop Loss. I've only seen this in the title. What is this one?
This is about these soldiers who are coming in Iraq, and the guy refuses to go back, and he won't go back and fight despite the government's mandate to make him go back. And it has a great cast: Ryan Phillippe, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and Channing Tatum, and this has gotten a lot of buzz because it's her first film, and wow, I think since Boys Don't Cry, which is 99, if I'm not mistaken, so it's like 9 years, so there's a lot of buzz around this film.
Yeah, I bet. I've read it's been covered a lot, I know already.
Yeah.
So it's going to be one that they're definitely going to talk about. And yet another in the line of Iraq-themed movies. That,
yeah, I don't expect this one. I'd be curious to see if this one is the one that breaks out or not. You know, you always think that.
I'm very curious what that first Iraq-themed movie will be that will, what it will take.
I honestly don't know. And then the other one, the curiosity, I guess, and this is the Morgan Spurlock film. What is it? Where in the World is Osama Bin Laden?
Right.
Which is, no one's saying anything really great about that one. But I'm curious about that. I like Super Size Me a lot. But
I like Super Size Me too. But I think this is an example of trying to build up anticipation so much for a film. You know, they hinted around that they got the golden they got the gold ring with this movie,
right,
leading people to believe that they had located Bin Laden. And when you tease someone like that and you don't deliver, I think that's accounting for some of the disappointment that you read in some of these reviews.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of disappointment, almost bordering on anger. Like you said, I mean, to promise something or at least to give that impression and not deliver.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a dangerous tightrope to walk.
And especially with that subject matter, you don't want to play around with that. You really don't.
No, but I hope that it's an investigation like Super Size Me was about getting to the bottom of why we haven't captured him yet.
Mm-hmm.
Is it because we lost interest? It wasn't a priority anymore. It wasn't a directive that took priority anymore, like it did, you know, right after 9/11. So I hope he explores that aspect.
I hope so too. I'd be very curious. I would actually give it definitely at least, you know, stick with it if it went along with that premise. If it followed that track, I think that.
Yeah,
would
yeah, but he's a very different filmmaker than Michael Moore. I mean, they're both good, but I don't see that Morgan Spurlock is as sharp a satirist or as confrontational a filmmaker as Michael Moore is.
Yeah, he's not. Michael Moore is like the P.T. Barnum of documentary filmmakers. He's a showman first and foremost. I wouldn't. He's in a category all by himself.
And this really strikes me as Morgan Spurlock attempting to do a Michael Moore type work.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. And also, and I know you're looking forward, I'm actually looking forward to this, but I have lowbrow taste. Harold and Kumar Escape from Guantanamo Bay. Why that needs to be at South by Southwest, I don't know. I think they got a built-in audience for that. But that is going to be there, as well as Forgetting Sarah Marshall, the newest thing from Jude Apatow. He's a producer on that. It has some of his usual cast of characters.
So why the hell is that premiering at a prestigious film festival?
I don't know, but that's fine. I mean, I'm very curious about both of those, but I don't know why you would need the. You have a built-in.
Is it shot in Austin? Is it an Austin-based movie?
I don't think so. I don't think so at all. But that struck me when I saw that earlier tonight. I was like, why are these premiering there?
Yeah. What are you talking about? Well, actually, the first film was well acclaimed. Actually, a lot of people enjoyed it. The first Harold and Kumar.
Oh, I thought it was great.
Yeah. So it's, you know, there have been occasions, and we've covered it just recently, where not so prestigious movies get, you know, placed in prestigious company, like Norbit, nominated for an Oscar this year.
That's true. I know Harold and Kumar gets my. I mean, there's supposed to be another one after this. I welcome it. They're very funny. Those movies. So I look forward to this one. I'm not going to lie to you. That looks very funny. It's a funny trailer, and you got this whole cult around Neil Patrick Harris is in it. So, you know, everyone seems to love that. So,
yeah, there's something that's happened since he came out. Do you sense that? Like, there's a, I don't know if it's he's enjoying his life more, or people are responding to him more now.
Maybe, I'm not sure. I just think he's also. He's having fun. He just seems, but you're right. He's definitely having a lot more fun. He seems a lot more loose.
Yes, since he did that, but I think also it's the appeal of It's the pop culture aspect of it, you know, that he is Doogie Howser.
He's always going to be Doogie Howser.
Yeah, and he's sitting around, you know, rolling J's with a group, or I don't know. I don't know the lingo with you young people.
Yeah, you don't know. But he's great. No, it's great. When he shows up in that first movie, it's hysterical. You're just like, oh, my God, it's Doogie Howser.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's just great. I mean, I had him. All right. No, but those are some of the films.
South by Southwest.
South by Southwest. I don't
it's
know.
A big
I don't
festival.
Have a listing of
and,
the music and, bands that will be there. But,
It is a big festival, and,
Oh, shit. No. Just stop the press.
What?
Mr. Lonely, directed by Harmony Korine. Do you know who Harmony Korine is?
No. Film again.
Did the movie Gummo.
Really?
Gummo and Julian Donkey Boy, which Julian Donkey Boy is his second film. And Werner Herzog is in it. And it plays the father. And it's one of those great moments for, you know, one of the great director as an actor performances. But, oh, this is reason to celebrate. I had no idea. I've been wondering what this guy has been up to the last couple of years. Oh, we got to get him on the show.
The director of Gummo.
Yes.
What is his name?
Harmony Korine.
Harmony?
Harmony, yeah. He's. I think he used to go out with, or he still might go out with Chloe Sivenji. I'm not sure.
Oh, okay.
But Werner Herzog's in this. Diego Luna. Samantha Morton. Oh, my. All right,
Samantha
I'm going to read
to
you what this is about, and hopefully
okay,
they won't throw us off the air.
What's it called, Mr.?
Mr. Lonely.
Mr. Lonely. Story of my life.
Shut up.
I cast Werner Herzog as myself, too.
He's one of the great. All right, a Michael Jackson impersonator lives alone in Paris and performs on the streets to make ends meet. At a performance in a retirement home, Michael falls for a beautiful Marilyn Monroe lookalike who suggests he move to a commune of impersonators in the Scottish Highlands. Oh, dude, we got to have him on. Oh, my.
Movie.
This, Gummo, when they showed the trailer for Gummo, was right in front of Boogie Nights. And it just sort of like, everyone was just like, oh, my.
Oh, my.
That's really cool.
That's another thing I could do. I can do that Star Trek guy with my new cold-infested voice. Oh, my. What is his name? The Asian.
Mr. Sulu.
Yeah, he's on Howard Stern all the time. What is his name?
Oh, George Takei.
Yeah, George Takei.
There you go. He's
oh, my.
Man. All right, but this, all right, this is looking up. We got, all right, I was wondering, I believe he also, if I'm not mistaken, he wrote Larry Clark's Kids.
Kids, yes, you're right. I have him up right now on the computer. You know, it's interesting because, you're a close friend, but my other close friends and I always talk about our worst film experience, and I have one good friend, he's called into the show several times, his name is Mark.
Mm-hmm.
He says Gummo is the only movie that he cannot tolerate, that he's ever walked out on.
Oh, did he see it in the theater, or?
No, I think he rented it.
Oh, he rented it, and he just couldn't, I've heard that, that, about that film, but it's, I guess it's, Korine is part of the American, at the time, Dogma 95 movement.
Yeah,
that's where, and he was a very, you know, for those two films, he definitely carried it off. And he wrote a book a while ago, "Crack Up at the Race Riots" or something that was very interesting. But I just was wondering what happened to him because Julian Donkey Boy is 99, and I just haven't seen or heard
Julian
of him.
Julian Donkey Boy.
I went out of my way to see that film. That was when I used to go
yeah,
out
I'm sure
of
it was
way.
A different movie than you thought it was.
Oh, dude, it was cool. I went back and told people at work the next day about it, and they're like, you saw it, we're jealous of you.
I can't imagine what you thought it was with a title like Julian Donkey Boy.
Oh, I knew what it was. I
mean, it's usually something that they put in a brown paper bag in the back of the store for you, though, isn't it? With a title like that?
They used to do that for me, but that store closed down and became a Jews for Jesus joint.
What is it called, like centaur sex? Half man, half horse?
Dude, you watched that Zoo movie too many times.
They did an SNL skit. It was a Christmas.
I know.
You know what I'm talking about, don't you?
I know exactly what you're talking about.
That's right. Oh, bye. Yeah. Anyway, back to serious film conversation. Yeah, South by Southwest, Texas, time and time again, comes up as one of the top places to filmmaker-friendly states.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly San Antonio area, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, isn't Austin, right? Isn't that...
Austin, right.
Right.
Right. We welcome everyone in our chat room, all two of you at this point.
Hello, Rub. Jeremy, how
hello,
you doing?
Rub and Eric. Thanks for joining us. If you have any questions, if you want to talk movies, you can give us a call. Apparently, our first guest is not showing up. This has been like the third or fourth rescheduling we've done with this guest, and he's very interesting. And maybe I'll just read the intro, and Jerry, you can pretend to be him. We can conduct the interview. That might be a fun way to spin the
that time. Might be that we could do that.
At the top of the hour, though, we will welcome the director of the new documentary, The Lobotomist, and this will blow your mind, man. This Walter Freeman, he was the first physician to attempt a transorbital lobotomy, or otherwise known as an ice pick lobotomy.
Ooh.
When you hear how rustic this procedure was, you will cringe. Honestly, an ice pick lobotomy through the eyelid into the brain. I'm going to have him express it in great detail.
I'm going to throw up while you're doing that.
Yeah, but it's a fascinating documentary because it talks about how a lot of things, including how little we knew about mental illness at the time, how our physicians were looked upon as gods who were beyond reproach. The arrogance
that's very
of that.
True.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a certain arrogance too, and where we didn't know what to do with our mentally disabled. The hospitals were akin to concentration camps. You know, we just dumped them off. It's a very interesting documentary. It premiered on PBS last week. It's available on a DVD, I believe, and for streaming on the web, too. You can see it on the web.
Right.
But he'll be on at the top of the hour, and then we'll replay our Joey Pants interview as well. But right now we're just talking movies. Anybody who wants to chime in, talk about any of the latest movie news, movies that you're looking forward to this summer,
The next couple of weeks, what, there's some interesting stuff coming out. I think there's interesting stuff coming out. But we've also, the writer's strike, they're going to have a meeting Saturday, I believe this weekend.
Right.
And there's a possibility this is the beginning of the end of the strike. But the WGA is going to meet with their membership Saturday, and maybe we might know something by the end of the weekend.
They're being very careful, and you know, because these rumors have been going on for the past couple of days. From the WGA's part, they're being very careful in making any official announcement of progress, because they're well aware that it might fall apart at any moment.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk of that, but like I just read this morning, Vanity Fair canceled their Oscar party.
Yes, they did.
That's a big deal.
It is a tradition. It is the biggest party for the past 15 years, post-Oscar party.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a big deal because it's the one that was the most kind of prestigious and star-studded.
Right.
But I think that the Oscars are happening, man. I think
the Oscars are going to happen. Sid Gannis basically gave this thing at the luncheon with the nominees, I believe it was the beginning of this week, where he said, you need to come.
Right.
I mean, it was kind of like, you just say, you have to come, strike or no strike. So that was interesting. But they're going on the assumption that people will produce the Oscars that is going on.
Yeah, I hope so, because I'm like a little kid with the Oscars.
Yeah, I mean, you can't have a press conference for the Oscars. It's just not going to fly. You can't do that. You can't have a replay of what happened with the Golden Globes. I don't think anyone's going to tolerate it. I get a huge good vibe from Jumper, okay? I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, I don't really. It looks fine. It just doesn't look like a Doug Liman movie to me.
I'll tell you what it is. It is a young actor grasping for life in the post-Star Wars world. Hayden Christensen is hanging on to dear life.
You know, I don't see that, though. I see that he's really been impressive in Shattered Glass. You know what I think the thing with Hayden Christensen is? And I think we've talked about this before on the show. I don't think he's capable of much more at this stage of the game.
No, I think you're right. I watched that one with Jessica Alba awake.
Yeah.
I was getting sick while I was watching that, not because of the movie per se, but because...
I think his money shot has been Shattered Glass, creatively.
Yeah, I think...
And I think it might be another 20 years before he comes up with something that he can find his particular, he can put a particular original voice to, you know. I think he's still kind of discovering.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a sense I get.
Yeah, he's, you know, it's when you're stuck with like an iconic part like that at a young age, and it is an iconic role, regardless of what, I mean, to play that part, it's a burden, and, you know, we'll have to see how he comes out. Although I got to say, with Jumper, because it is a Doug Liman film, I'm given a lot of confidence.
Yeah, me too. I mean, that's the selling point to the movie. But looking at the movie and previews and things, it seems, you know, this time of year seems to be a dumping ground anyway. It seems like a less than stellar kind of Doug Liman. You wouldn't know it was Doug Liman if you weren't told, necessarily.
No, not if you weren't told, but maybe after watching, you'd be like, oh, wow, you know.
Probably.
Yeah.
I just read something that Marco Beltrami, he composed the third Terminator film.
Yeah, yeah.
He says, and he will be on our show on Wednesday, he says that there has been talk for him to compose Terminator 4.
Well, that would be enormous.
So let's see if we can get a scoop on Wednesday from Mr. Beltrami. That's another little nugget that maybe we can.
Yeah, we can definitely get that out there. I'm curious about this. It's not even Terminator 4. It's basically going to be like a whole new trilogy of films with Christian Bale is signed on to play, I believe, John Connor in the film. So I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah. Eric in the chat room, and anyone that wants to call into the show.
You can call in, and you can talk about whatever you want. It's not like a sign, you know, like a pop quiz or anything. You can talk about whatever you want. We're not strict.
Wants to know our thoughts on Iron Man.
I don't think I've ever seen someone more suited to play the role than Robert Downey Jr. He was born to play Tony Stark. I will say that right now.
Yeah.
I don't mean that in my usual flippant, tongue-in-cheek way, but given his, you know, his background and how he's rebounded, he's the perfect person to play Tony Stark.
And it is inspired casting, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
And it's casting that I think if it were left up to only the studio's discretion, they wouldn't have made. I think it's a brilliant casting choice
mm-hmm,
on Favreau's part. And Favreau really pulled for him, and I think the movie is probably 1,000% better for it.
Yeah, oh, I agree, definitely. And Favreau is a great. He really impresses me as a director. I do like him, so I think he's the right person for this film.
He's somebody that's getting better and better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he started. You think of how he started in his independent roots, and how even in his big budget efforts, how he still maintains that.
Yeah,
that spirit.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good, refreshing kind of combination.
It is,
and you can see it in his cast. I mean, you can see that independent spirit in his cast with, you know, Terrence Howard, Gwyneth Paltrow, Robert Downey Jr., Jeff Bridges, all of this
mm-hmm.
Iron Man. I mean, you're talking about a sledgehammer cast in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a great, awesome trailer.
Awesome trailer.
Awesome.
Super Bowl exposure.
Yes.
First movie out of the gate in the summer, the official first movie of the summer, May 2nd.
And it just gets, it's going to be a gauntlet once again this summer, folks. I mean, I think all the way up till really the end of August, it's really, I don't think there's going to be a moment to catch your breath this summer.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be crazy.
Well, Iron Man has a 2-week lead to, how long does it have? It's got like a 2-week lead time before another big film comes out.
Does it? Okay, because I thought the following week is Speed Racer, and then is Prince Caspian in May or is it in June? I don't know. I mean,
I know it has May 22nd until any.
May 22nd is the big one. I hope no one is really seriously thinking about releasing anything else that weekend.
No, you shouldn't.
You really shouldn't.
Because we're talking about Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull on May 22nd. And some new photos have surfaced. And Jerry, you and I talked about this the other night.
Yeah, because I tried to find it, and the studio took it down.
One photo
yeah.
shows Indiana Jones in a warehouse filled with boxes that kind of alludes to a rumor that's been going around that he goes back to where they stored the Ark of the Covenant in the first film, at the end of the first film. Remember
right.
that famous shot at the very end? So they've said that the sequel really comes like full circle. You have Marion who's back,
mm-hmm.
who looks fantastic. I mean, she hasn't aged a day. You have the Ark of the Covenant possibly playing a role again. And then another photo came out of the actual crystal skull, and it looks undoubtedly like an alien skull.
Right.
So that's another rumor that's been going around, that this Indiana Jones, it takes place in the 50s, that it somehow involves Area 51 and aliens as well.
Right.
And there's been some controversy over that. Some Indiana Jones fans don't like the idea of him working with, you know, working off of like the alien theme, you know. But at the same time, there's supernatural elements to each of these movies.
Yeah, and I gotta tell you, folks, they've been talking about Area 51 as a plot point since the early 90s,
mm-hmm.
and especially ever since there's been an internet. Area 51 has been one of the major plot points of this fourth movie, regardless of who's been attached to writing it at whatever time. The Area 51, I think at first, maybe in the early 90s, it might have been Atlantis, because like a famous graphic novel, Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis, but no, Area 51, I think we got closer to aliens would somehow
yeah.
be involved in this.
We have a call, and I know who it is. I think this is our good friend and listener, Eric. Eric G., are you with us? Eric, go right ahead. All right.
Hello.
Maybe he terminated his call. Eric, are you with us? Oh, come on, man. I pick up your line. I'm all ready for you. All right, maybe he'll call back.
Maybe.
I'm excited, personally. Do you think it's going to end like Close Encounters? Like Harrison Ford becomes like the Richard Dreyfuss character? Does he get in the spaceship or not?
That's very funny you say that, but you know, I remember what Spielberg said a couple of years ago, like talking about Close Encounters. He said, "I couldn't make that movie today. It would be so irresponsible to have a father leave his family." So I don't think
exactly, yeah.
But no, that's great.
Did you ever consider that?
That would be hysterical, man. I'd be on the floor. I'd be like, "Oh my God, I can't believe it!" And the little boy comes back and everything.
Yeah, but you can't do that. I mean, you could do that. That would be a major, like, oh, come on. Like, I would see that as a big disappointment for fans.
Yes,
but.
It would be.
Okay, I think he's back on the line. Let's see what he has to say. Eric G., are you with us?
Yes, can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
All right, outstanding.
How you doing, man?
Pretty good, buddy. How are you?
Good. What you looking forward to this summer?
You know me. Kind of out of the loop a lot when it comes to movies lately. I was going to say, I depend on you and Jerry to give me the information I need so I can make an educated decision on what to do.
Okay.
We appreciate that. We are your consumer reports, my friend.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I depend on you guys. I've seen mixed reviews on this new movie that's out called The Eye with Jessica Alba.
Oh, yeah? It's a remake of a Thai movie. Which is actually pretty decent, but it's nothing. I mean, like with a lot of these remakes, Eric, it doesn't have subtitles, you know? That's
right.
That's really all it is. There's nothing really. I didn't think The Eye was anything to write home.
Now, like Thai food, does it burn your stomach and make you throw up after you watch it?
No, I got a confession to make. If you have trouble sleeping, go see the movie. It will put you to sleep.
It will make you close your eye.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
That's what I depend on you guys for, right there.
That's right. That's right. We just saved
trouble staying awake the first half hour. I mean, really, not that it got better, but I think I managed to. Maybe it's because I got a Coke or something. I don't know, but
The Eye. I saw a movie called The One Eye the other night. it's a different kind of film. I did throw up after.
Yeah.
Eric, are you excited? Are you like as giddy as we are about Indiana Jones? I mean, doesn't make you feel like a kid again, knowing that there's an Indiana Jones right around the corner?
Well, and that's the thing too. I mean, these are movies that we grew up watching.
Right.
I mean, I remember being a kid and you know couldn't wait till another one came out, and now you know all of a sudden here's another one on the horizon,
mm-hmm.
and I mean it's very nostalgic. You know, you start thinking about. You know, start remembering back, you know, when you were a kid and
right.
growing up and playing Indiana Jones and all these different things outside, you know, when you're a kid or whatever. And, when I was growing up, I mean, Jim, you know my brother, and, he's always wanted to do films and things like that, too. And, you know, one of the things that he would always do is take his video camcorder and recreate scenes from Indiana Jones using his little brother, which would be me, you know, whatever way that we could do out, you know, outside in the yard. So, yeah, I'm definitely excited about it. I'm definitely looking forward to it, and can't wait for it to hit theaters.
Man, and there's something like iconic about, because it's like when we were kids, you're talking about this, we wanted to find some kind of hat that we could use for Indiana Jones, and
yeah,
some kind of jacket.
Yeah.
There's just something iconic just about that outfit itself.
Right.
You know, where it's just like perfect, and I've seen a couple of pictures, and I'm like looking at the outfit, and I'm like, this looks too clean. Are the colors exactly the same as they were like 20 years ago? And yeah, I'm such a, like a nerd about it. But do you think though, and this is a real worry, that the last movie was almost 20 years ago? It's hard to believe. Do you think the youth of today know it as well as we do?
No, I don't think it's going to be such a following of it from today's youth as it was, you know, when we were growing up. I mean, it's a lot like you guys were talking about Star Wars earlier. It's a lot like the original Star Wars movies.
Right.
And all of
yeah.
us, you know, all of us who grew up in that time and had all the action figures and all
right.
the different things that we played with, you know, when they start talking about, you know, new Star Wars movies, everybody's biting at the bit. And today's
yeah,
youth
but
is kind
I,
of like
I,
today's.
I get the sense from Star Wars, though, that those hardcore fans from 20, 30 years ago, they've raised their kids on the Star Wars movie since. So it does have multiple generational kind of appeal.
Yeah, this might. It depends. I mean, you don't. I think as we get closer, there's going to be a lot of anticipation, even from the young moviegoers, because they'll want to see what go. Like, hey, you know, my father showed me these, or my older brothers, you know. Showed me these movies. I really can't wait.
Right.
Yeah, if nothing else, the young people want to see, you know, because they've grown up, today they've grown up in Jackass and stuff. They want to see Harrison Ford try to run around with a colostomy bag. So I think that just that curiosity factor alone. Excuse me, I'm what? Sick. I'm deranged. I'm sorry.
Great. I didn't know he was going to be running around with that, too. Wow.
You know, it was so funny because they came
trying to rip it off him. I mean,
did you see like the initial photos? And I believe in Harrison Ford. Harrison Ford kicks ass. I mean, he's timeless. I don't care how old he gets. I want to see him play this part. But there was a picture of him like he's in a cave with Shia LaBeouf, and he's squatting. And there were some captions beneath it, like possible titles: Indiana Jones and the Accidental Poot.
Oh, that's cold blooded. Oh my.
I thought I was inspired.
Oh my.
But that's going to be a big question. Like, you know, is he too old to play the part?
I don't think he's too old. I think the age thing will work in perfectly.
Yeah. I think they're writing that in
yeah.
to make it believable. Like they did with, like, Riggs with the fourth Lethal Weapon, you know. Like,
right.
but there's also, remember Roger Moore when he was ending his Bond days?
Right.
And he could barely even walk, and people were saying, come on, Mal, he can't keep playing Bond. Yeah. And he's wearing glasses that weigh, like, 30 pounds, you know, because he can't see worth a shit. And I love Roger Moore, first of all. If he's ever going to be a guest on my show, I love him. But, you know, it's the same thing.
Roger Moore, we love you. Don't listen to Jamie.
But did you see the Iron Man trailer during the Super Bowl, Eric?
Yeah, I did, and it looked really, you know, really, really cool, and it looked like something that's definitely going to have, you know, at least the first weekend. I mean, all depending on how the, you know, how the story is and how the movie's made. You know, obviously, I think it's going to generate a lot of interest just from
ass.
Yeah,
I mean, it was
doing
like, whoa.
That weekend without a doubt.
Exactly. Jerry, do you have up like some of the? Pull up some of the summer schedule.
Oh yeah, yeah. Let me get that. Let me
pull up the calendar and let's go between the three of us. Because Eric, I don't know if we've talked about this. This summer is packed.
Dude,
I mean,
it's big.
Like,
I mean, it's enormous.
You wouldn't believe we have a writer's strike now because one week after another, I mean, there's some bigger and bigger things coming out.
Right.
So we'll wait for Jerry. Let's.
Okay,
let's play.
I'm going to start with. I'm going to start with May 2nd. We'll just focus on the big movies right now. We're not going to deal with the little ones. We worship the little ones. But May 2nd, Iron Man. Then the following week, May 9th, Speed Racer.
Speed Racer. That's the new movie from the Matrix filmmakers, the Wachowski brothers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right, May 16th, The Chronicles of Narnia, Prince Caspian. And just What Happens in Vegas, I'm not sure what, I should know what that is, but I don't, and Midnight Meat Train, which is based on a Clive Barker story,
yeah.
I believe. I've seen trailers for that in front of Rambo.
Midnight Meat Train, I saw that the other night, too.
Yeah.
It's a double feature with the one eye.
I bet it was. And of course, May 22nd, Indiana Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And then the following week, May 30th, the Sex and the City movie, and that is, I'd be very curious to see how that does.
You cannot discount the Sex and the City movie, man.
You can't. You really can't.
Female audience is a powerful force when you appeal to them.
And a popular, very popular show.
Yeah, I mean, Eric, have you ever watched, you don't have to admit it, but have you ever watched an episode of that show?
Well, I'm married, so yeah.
eat it up, women eat it up. So.
Oh, they love it. They absolutely adore it.
That movie's going to be big. Mark my words. It's going to be like, you know how Devil Wears Prada, there's always one. Like the
right.
Devil Wears Prada was 2 years ago. During that summer, women just flocked to it. And it's a great movie, actually, too.
It was
the surprise, like, sleeper hit of that summer. A lot bigger than some of the blockbusters that they expected to perform.
It did much better than Superman Returns. It came out the same time, and...
Yeah, it was a much better movie, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, June 6th, Kung Fu Panda, that's the one with Jack Black. And the Adam Sandler movie, You Don't Mess with the Zohan.
Played during the Super Bowl, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a funny concept, I'm not going to lie to you, but it's June 13th is pretty big.
But, Eric, you like Adam Sandler still, right?
Oh, yeah, I love him.
Yeah, what's not to like?
Hysterically.
What's
that? I mean, I've heard a lot of people, you know, bash... and I'll pronounce you Chuck and Larry. And you know, for what it was meant to be, I thought it was a decent movie. Obviously, it wasn't anything, you know, to borrow a phrase from Jerry earlier, to write home about. But it was good for what it was worth, you know, what it was made to be. It was made to make you laugh.
It's an Adam Sandler movie, and you know his fans like you will flock to anything he makes. I mean,
sure.
He delivers what they want, you know, and you know that's why I stay away. But you know,
all right. Well,
your cup of tea.
June 13th is pretty big. We have the M. Night Shyamalan movie, The Happening, which the teaser trailer debuted this week, and we also have Edward Norton as the Incredible Hulk.
Yeah.
So that's two biggies right there.
And isn't it ironic? Every time I think about summer movies, I think about the big ones like Indiana Jones, like the Will Smith big action movie that we'll be talking about in just a second, Iron Man, Speed Racer. I always forget about The Incredible Hulk and The Happening. And for them to open up on the same day, I would move The Happening's date, personally. But the trailer for The Happening just came out, and never discount M. Night Shyamalan, because this movie looks fascinating. I can't tell what's going on. Are people just... falling down dead left and right out of the blue, or what is the story?
I don't know what the story is. I have to say it's his first R-rated film.
Oh, good.
So there's a lot of possibility with this one.
And Mark Wahlberg says that it's the best shoot he's ever been on. I mean, he's worked with Scorsese, he's worked with some great people.
That's interesting.
He said this is the best experience I've ever had shooting a movie.
Yeah, so. No, that would be interesting. But I don't know much about Edward Norton's Incredible Hulk. I really don't know that much. So
well,
I haven't heard anything.
Yeah, he wrote the script. He actually co-wrote the script. Edward Norton did.
Okay.
Maybe. Right. But the big one is the next week, isn't it?
The week after that, we have Get Smart.
Okay.
We have Get Smart and The Love Guru, which I believe is a Mike Myers film, which, you know, there's a lot riding on that because Mike Myers hasn't been in a big, like, live-action hit in a long time.
And this is another character he spent years creating.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a comedy force, man, so you can't discount him. And what was the other one that you just mentioned? It was the...
Get Smart.
Get Smart. Steve Carell.
I have to see. That's a curiosity right there. Anne Hathaway and Steve Carell playing Maxwell Smart. So,
see, something's got to bomb for all these movies to go up against each other. Something's got to give.
With some of the ones we've mentioned, there are possibilities for that. But it's June 27th. We have Pixar's WALL-E.
Yeah,
and that looks good. I'm a big Pixar fan, and I have to say that looks very promising.
That was on during the Super Bowl too, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, they spent some money, and then DreamWorks. especially all their not DreamWorks, but Disney, especially all their Pixar stuff, man, guaranteed. I mean, it's money in the bank.
Yeah. The thing I find most interesting, the thing I watch closest and with the most interest is staying power. I mean, because we're talking about, you know, Indiana Jones and the Hulk, and, you know, these movies are going to do great that, you know, the opening weekend.
That's key.
I always watch real close, and I always watch with a lot of anticipation to see what's going to happen. You know, is it going to be a big drop off? Is it going to stay? You know, I mean, that's what I find most interesting.
Right, and especially since all these action movies, they're essentially clamoring for the same audience.
Yeah,
right.
You know,
I was shocked by the lack of staying power of Cloverfield. I thought it would stay a little bit more than it did, and it just dropped.
I kind of expected that.
But
because
so big.
Because the people that were sold that movie with the expectation, they all went to see that opening weekend so they could be on top of it.
Right.
And beyond that, I mean, that audience found it. That audience was there the opening weekend.
Do you think it's the same audience that went to go see Meet the Spartans too?
No. Well, I don't know. I don't want to talk about that atrocity.
No, I don't either. I just thought I just
for Meet the Spartans
just...
to beat a kick-ass movie like Rambo. And I'm sorry, I love Rambo.
Hey, Rambo was great. You're not going to hear any complaints from me.
Yeah, I loved it. Which Stallone, did you hear? You got like a two-picture deal based on Rambo, the success of Rambo and Rocky.
Oh, good.
Oh, really?
He's like on top again.
All right, great. He's the man.
Go ahead, man.
I think that falls in the same category. We were talking earlier about Harrison Ford and Indiana Jones, about his age.
Right.
And you look at Sylvester Stallone, and with his age now, and he comes back out with, you know, Rocky and with Rambo, and does so well. And I think it's just a testament to the fact that, you know, something, I mean, because Rambo's another, you know, another series of films that we grew up watching.
That's right.
You know, and then all of a sudden, you know, 20 years later, 15 years later, whatever it is, here comes another one, and it does so well. I think it just kind of votes for the confidence of Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
Plus the fact, like, you know, like we were saying, we grew up on it. So people in our generation are going to flock to see this movie.
Are you insinuating that Harrison Ford is on the roids? Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't think he's
on the roids. I think he's trying to get Firewall and Hollywood Homicide out of his system.
Yeah, I like Hollywood Homicide. So what's first weekend of June we're looking at? July, I think we're looking at.
July, Hancock. Now, this is the Will Smith movie.
Where he plays like the average Joe, but he happens to be a superhero.
Right. Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen that trailer.
Who directs this? I don't know who directs this. So,
I think a comic director. No. Peter Berg.
Okay. Peter Berg. That's very promising.
Yeah.
I would thought this was, for a second the way you describe it is like, oh my god, it's the male version of my super ex girlfriend.
Right.
And no one wants that. No one.
No. No, please don't.
But you haven't even mentioned the biggest movie of the summer yet.
Well,
we haven't gotten there.
We haven't gotten there because before we get to July 18th, I want to bring up July 11th, which is
okay.
Hellboy 2, The Golden Army, and Tropic Thunder. Tropic Thunder is another one.
That's Ben Stiller, right?
Yeah, that I'm kind of looking forward to. But yes, July 18th is the big one. And I'm not talking about Space Chimps. I am talking about The Dark Knight.
The Dark Knight, man, the new Batman
Dark
movie.
Knight.
Right.
Yeah.
God, that thing's going to rock. Excuse me. I have to pleasure myself.
Yeah.
Great. Folks, anything can happen. This is live radio. Thank God I'm in another state.
let me pull up the one I have.
Easy.
That's
amazing. Speaking of, when are we going to get like Tara Patrick on the show or someone, or Jenna Jameson speaking of this?
I've seriously been thinking about doing a show on the adult entertainment industry.
I was just like a continuing like feature, maybe like have like on, you know, every other week, you know, someone call in.
Yeah, just the research alone would be worth it.
You being a connoisseur and all.
But you know, I need the bad thing is I need one hand for the phone and one hand for the switchboard.
Oh,
so.
Okay, that's enough.
Yeah, that would be a disadvantage for you.
Where'd you learn to talk like that? Some Panama City sailor want a hump pump bar?
That's it.
No, but actually, all right. If The Dark Knight is going to be, that's going to be an experience.
It's going to be bigger than The Black Knight, the Martin Lawrence movie. That's my prediction. That's my prediction.
No, but I think with this film...
Going out on a limb there, aren't you, Jamie?
Yeah.
Yeah, you really are. I mean, really, I think Martin Lawrence. Are you going to see Welcome Home, Roscoe Jenkins? Is that?
Oh, is that his new movie?
That's his
new movie.
No, Skip.
Hey, rush out and see that one.
I think, like, when you see the trailer for that, don't you feel like you've seen the whole movie? And that's too much that you've seen?
Exactly.
I feel that way about every trailer now, basically.
Yeah.
Show me something I haven't seen before. That's why I was almost relieved about Cloverfield. I mean, there wasn't anything to be really majorly secretive about with Cloverfield other than the design of the monster.
Right.
But I felt that the design of the monster was more inspired by, and I know, Jerry, you talked about this on a show you did last week, by the host than anything else, because it really seemed like an amalgam of all these different monster parts just kind of stitched together, you know?
Right.
Anyway, I'm off base. The 18th is The Dark Knight. What do we got after that?
We also have Mamma Mia that
matter?
Day, too.
Mamma Mia, the musical.
Yeah.
Eric will be there.
And then the 25th we have, I'm looking forward to this, The X-Files 2.
Oh! Yeah, we've completely forgotten about X-Files 2.
Yeah, so that's going to be, and August 1st we have Choke, what we were talking about.
But that's the big question mark. That's been off movie. I mean, that's been off TV and movie screens for what, 15 years? How long's it been?
No, it's since I believe. 2000 or 2001, I think.
I was way off.
You were way, dude. Really? I mean, I did horribly.
I'm out of you.
School, but whoa.
But is the awareness factor still there? I mean, I would think that it would be because people are rabid about the X-Files.
And it's.
Right, it's still gonna have a huge following. I mean, it's still gonna be. You know, if people like me, like Jerry's talking about, is something he's very interested in. I'm sure Jerry went and was there opening weekend for the first one.
Yeah, and he's
going to be there again,
like,
for the second one. I mean,
and when I went to go see it, a friend of mine, you know, I walked out, I saw someone, and we were talking about it, and we're just like, wow, that just a whole bunch of new questions and answered nothing, but we liked
right.
it, but it was just like, you know, it just opened up more.
Yeah.
No closure whatsoever.
None. So I'd be very curious. Although they say this movie, from what I've heard so far, has nothing to do with the popular mythology storyline. There's going to be a whole new story.
Huh.
So I'm very curious to see what that is.
Yeah, I submitted an interview request to Duchovny, actually. I can't remember for what. Last week. And received word that, you know, he's too busy shooting X-Files, I think,
right.
in Canada, to do any interviews.
Wow, okay.
But these are the people I talk to on a daily basis, man.
Well, I would imagine that they've got
the people that tell me no on behalf of much bigger people.
Right.
That's my place in the world.
No, but those are some of the big films this summer.
Is there any August sleepers? You know, like sometimes
maybe what we talked about earlier, there is a new Mummy movie, but I don't know if that's a sleeper, but
it'll make me go to sleep, I'm sure.
Okay, great. We'll probably have everyone from that movie on the show. Try to erase that part of the show. The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants 2 is coming out. The Pineapple Express is coming out.
That's an animated thing, isn't it?
And the Pineapple Express? No, the Pineapple Express, if I'm not mistaken,
Motion capture?
No, nothing quite like that. Just give me a second.
That's all right. I don't want to know that bad.
Oh, no. No, you want to know. You want to know, because this is gold right here.
Okay.
Directed by David Gordon Green, written by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg.
Huh.
And who else? Seth Rogen, James Franco, Bill Hader. Yes, it's all of our Gary Cole, Rosie Perez. Oh, yeah, this is going to be a big one.
Wow, Rosie Perez. Wow.
Yeah, so those are some of the things.
Yikes.
That we're looking forward to.
Well, Eric, we talked about the whole summer lineup with you. Half hour of the show gone.
Outstanding.
And man, time flies when you're on the show, man.
That's right. Well, I appreciate it, guys.
All right.
Appreciate you calling in,
dude.
You'll
have to call and have a good night.
You do the same, Jerry.
Thank you.
All right, buddy. I'll talk to you soon. Bye, man.
Okay, man. Bye.
It's great friend to us and a great friend to the show. That's Eric G. Thank you for spending some time with us tonight on the show.
Yes, thank you.
It's a big lineup for the summer, man.
It's enormous.
What will falter? I mean, something's got to give.
Well, I don't want to, you know, you know, go there right now. We don't want to do that.
But there are absolutes. I mean, there are absolutes. Indiana Jones, Batman, and I think Hancock. Absolutes.
Oh, those, yeah, those will do incredibly well. I think a lot of these will do very well. I think Speed Racer will do well. I think the Narnia will do well. Obviously, WALL-E will do very, very well.
Yeah, yeah, WALL-E.
Yeah, yeah, so those are, and I think Hellboy 2 will do very well, too, so.
Hellboy 2, is that an August release?
Oh, that's in July. That's in between Hancock and The Dark Knight. Talk about a tight schedule. I mean, very crowded. Very
it is
crowded.
Very crowded. It is very crowded. What do you think of this new movie that we haven't discussed it on the show yet? We've discussed it between the two of us. That Oliver Stone announced. Bush. Bush.
Bush. You should make it sound like you, I feel like you're doing the ad for the beer.
The beer commercial, yeah.
You know, Head for the Mountains.
Head for Bush beer.
It's interesting. You know, I think it's an interesting choice. Josh Brolin is going to play him. He's going to get this out before the end of his term, is I'm under the impression.
That would be tricky. But Oliver Stone has worked very fast in the past. If you count that he made The Doors and JFK back to back, and he had like a 6 to 9 month window from the start of production of JFK to the time it was released. And if you look at JFK, what a massive achievement that was, especially under such pressure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't put it past Stone that he can deliver a Bush film before the end of his term.
Right. I'm just curious what the shelf life of the film will be. It's a curiosity. I don't know what, you know, I don't, you know, he's still the, it's, well, it will, look, it will cause a lot of controversy. It'll be very interesting to see how, what the final product is. I don't know anything else about it.
Well,
and the Rub said it. The Rub actually said it best. It seems a bit too soon. And I understand what he means by that. And you can correct me, Jeremy, if I'm wrong. We're not talking about the 9/11 movies where it was too soon, but here we're talking about he's still in office. We're not even he's a very unpopular president. I know that's putting it mildly, but the full effect of presidencies, and there's been a lot of articles in the national papers lately. Really, it's too soon to really measure it. You have to take a distance.
Right.
Years, if not decades, to really evaluate a presidency, and I'm not making any excuses for any president. But I think it may be you might want to wait a couple years to make this kind of movie. But I understand he wants to get this out of his system, perhaps. So we'll see.
Yeah, I kind of know what you're talking about. I mean, in terms of shelf life, I think it will always have a shelf life. Because Bush will always be one of our presidents.
Exactly.
And one of the most infamous presidencies in our history.
Right.
So I don't worry about that aspect of it. But there is something to be said of allowing yourself a certain distance from the now. You know,
right.
Where you can accurately assess the overall significance of that presidency. And I think that's what he allowed himself with Nixon.
I agree. And I think I need that. I also think,
and this is about George. This is about our current president.
Yeah, it's not about.
It isn't about the first Bush. I would actually be interested in Stone making a movie about that family, because that family's role in American politics really goes back. I mean, to our current president's grandfather, Preston.
Right. Yeah, it does. It does go back.
Who
to that.
Was a very interesting character in his own right, and probably the most noble of all the Bushes as well.
Right.
But it's a very fascinating story about a political dynasty. That's what I would like to have come.
I think that would be a much better film. There are a lot of great books written about that.
Yeah.
But I think you actually bring up a good, and it's very interesting. You know, remember when Bush, the first Bush's term, he was not considered a great president, and then the son comes around, and everyone's all of a sudden hailing the father's presidency as much better.
Right.
And you notice that spin that was going around a couple of years ago, like the father knew not to go into it, you know, never to invade Iraq and all that. They're hailing him as a genius. So it's
right.
You know, like you say, a couple of years of distance. And
what I'm wondering is, why no plans for Reagan, out of all the presidents, out of all the presidents that gets talked about so much, and a president that had natural built-in, you know, literally movie star charisma, very like congenial, very great sense of humor, and very powerful. And
there was a biopic. Remember the movie The Reagans?
Oh, that's the James Branch Bolin. Yeah.
And remember,
I'm wondering why no big screen treatment of that. Why we're going?
First of all, while he was alive, they weren't going to do it because of he was very ill, the Alzheimer's. They weren't going to touch that. No one wanted to touch it. I do think as time goes on, I am surprised. Why hasn't someone?
Why does somebody go to Bush before somebody like Reagan?
Yeah.
We've even got a feature documentary on Jimmy Carter now from Jonathan Demme.
Right.
Who would you cast as Reagan?
Well,
didn't Richard Crenna play him at one time?
I did think Richard Crenna did play him in the day that Reagan was shot.
That's right. That was a good film.
Yeah. That's a very good. Who would you get to play him? Because he was himself an actor. Who would you? I mean, do you have any thoughts off the top of your head?
No, I don't.
I don't either. That's
maybe Philip Baker Hall. Maybe Philip Baker Hall could be the first one to play Nixon and Reagan back to back.
That's not a bad choice, to be honest with you.
Thank you. That's why I'm a professional casting director.
That's not a bad choice to play him. There is a joke that you say Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Play Reagan.
I wouldn't put that past anyone. I think he would. I think he would relish the opportunity personally.
Yeah, I'm sure he would. He would have to learn how to pronounce California before he did it. I think our guest is on the line.
Okay, great.
Are you ready to get
yes,
to it?
I am.
Okay, our guest tonight is a terrific filmmaker, whose outstanding documentary work has been featured regularly by the likes of Frontline and The American Experience. He was nominated for an Oscar and won an Emmy for his film Scottsboro, An American Tragedy. Other remarkable works that grace his resume include probing examinations like Kinsey, The Boy in the Bubble, and 10 Days That Unexpectedly Changed America, Einstein's Letter. His new film, which premiered on PBS's American Experience just last week, is called The Lobotomist, and tells the story of a driven physician by the name of Walter Freeman and the controversial practice of ice-pick lobotomies for which he became known. It is a great pleasure to welcome filmmaker Barak Goodman to our program. We bring him up here. Mr. Goodman, are you with us?
I'm with you. Thank you for the introduction.
Thank you so much for being with us. Did I get it right? Was it Barak or Barak?
It's pronounced Barak, although I accept Barak because not only because of the situation in the world, but that's actually the Hebrew pronunciation, so it's fine.
Okay.
Oh, okay, great. Well, I loved your film, and I'm very honored that you chose to be with us tonight to discuss it. And I can't wait to do that with you. But first of all, tell me a little bit about how you got started in filmmaking. When the film bug first bit you, and what it was about documentaries particularly that got to you?
Well, I never intended to enter this field. I was well on my way to becoming a newspaper reporter, having gone to journalism school and started reporting. And I got a call from a local TV station in Philadelphia, which is where I'm from, to kind of come down and help them develop some shows, and I thought I'd try it for a year. I was very young, and I just loved the various skills that it calls upon. You know, it's not just reporting and writing; it's also use of music and images, as you know. And I really did fall in love with it. I've been doing it now for 20 years.
Wow! Now, was there ever a time that you wanted to move into narratives, or does the documentary form satisfy all of your instincts, creative instincts?
I love narrative films. I love feature films, but documentaries, and they're very different. People always ask me, why don't you try narrative filmmaking? It's almost like asking an opera singer to try rock and roll. They're very, very different things. And
yep.
Documentaries are enormously challenging. I love the complexity of and the spontaneity of documentaries. You know, they're often not scripted, and you go out and see what you get, and you try to craft a story out of real life. It's an enormous challenge, and the kind of challenge I really enjoy.
That's something that fascinates me about documentary filmmaking, and you just spoke to it. It seems like a real kind of tightrope that you walk,
yeah.
because you don't have a script. You don't know what you're finally going to come up with, or if you're going to reach a conclusion at all.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true of lots of documentaries. Some of the ones I make, some of the ones you mentioned are historical films. It's a little different. We do tend to script those. But yes, I mean, if you're going out into the world with a camera, thinking there might be a story, there's a tremendous anxiety that you're not going to get anything that you can mold or create a narrative out of. And often, you know, there's a temptation to try to bend the world to your story, and you really can't do that. You have to respond to what you get, you know, get out there and see. And it is a tightrope is a great metaphor for it, because you every time we go out we feel like this is it, we're going to fall off the tightrope and not have the story to tell. But it ends up working out most of the time.
Do you have documentaries that have been a particular influence on you, or filmmakers, or particular films that you've always looked to?
A huge number. I'm a huge fan of documentary in general, but. You know, I love the work of Errol Morris. I love his, I think, brilliant creativity visually and just sort of the ideas. I love Rick Burns as a filmmaker because he's so challenging and doesn't pander in any way. He tries to elevate the form. There's so many of them.
Yeah.
I love Verite films. You know, there's many, many of those, of course, in the last few years. It's really been a golden era the last decade, I think. It's really... The form has really flowered, and you've seen just fantastic films coming out of Sundance every year, for example.
The highlights of Sundance every year is the documentary offerings.
That tends to be the case, and certainly the last few years, the feeling out there has been that the documentaries have really been the ones pushing the envelope, and you know, the features, I think, with some exceptions, have been disappointing. So, yeah, I would agree with you.
Yeah, we have lots of documentary filmmakers on our program. We're crazy about the form, but why do you think it's caught on in recent years like it has?
I think the accessibility of the technology and the has beckoned a huge number of new filmmakers, really a whole new generation of filmmakers who are not sort of rule bound and kind of, you know, stuck in a trench creatively. They're the people who really just, you know, are totally kind of making it up as they go along, and you get very fresh stuff. I mean, some of the best documentaries coming out of Sundance, for example, and you see them nominated for Academy Awards every year, are made by first-time filmmakers.
Yeah.
No End in Sight, just as an example, last year.
That's a great one.
Was a first-time filmmaker, and you get this over and over again, and you're like, how does the person just go out and do it? Well, that's what's great about documentary film. It's not about, you know, kind of years and years of studied technique, and often it's about quite the opposite. It's about a kind of, you know, spontaneous creativity that comes from not knowing a lot about what you're doing, just kind of, you know, experimenting with it.
Right.
Yeah. And we often talk on the show about the power of, because obviously we're movie geeks, it's right in our title, but we honestly believe in the power of movies to change and transform lives and make our world a better place. And I think that qualifies most with documentaries, because so often with narrative features, I mean, we're giving, you know, kind of cookie cutter characters and the same situations we've seen over and over again. And documentaries tend to deal with stories that relate more personally to us and the human condition, and really involve you in a way that narratives kind of have failed to in the past few years, at least.
I agree. Yeah.
But looking back at some of these stories that you've told in your resume, what about a story has to appeal to you? What qualities does the subject have to have before you take it on?
Well, yeah, I do two. I'm privileged actually to do two very different kinds of films. You know, when I'm doing an historical documentary, usually for the series American Experience of PBS, you know, it's a real luxury. You get to pick from all of the greatest stories that have been ever told, and in American history at least. And what I've done in the last few years is chosen stories about very complex gray characters, people often, you know, who are motivated with the best of intentions but go off the rails. I mean, that's definitely true of this film, The Lobotomist,
yes.
For example.
Yes.
It's also true of the story of The Boy in the Bubble. It's true of Kinsey, for example, which was a film I did a few years ago. These are, you know, to me, I love stories where you don't really know what to think of the main character. You kind of, you're pulled this way and that, back and forth between, you know, admiring and loathing the same character. It's you know, there's a wonderful film, of course, you guys know, Let There Be Blood, out right now. I think the main character is that kind of character. It's
yes,
a character
he is.
Where you're both compelled and attracted and also repelled at the same time. And I love that. So those are the historical films. As far as the other kinds of films, it's just, you know, you're just looking for great stories, great narratives to tell.
Yeah, and you're definitely describing the lobotomist to a T when you're talking about that endless struggle between, you know, is this the implications of this man's work.
Yeah.
But tell me what how you came upon this story.
Mm-hmm. This was actually one of the few films I've done where someone came to me with the idea. In this case, the executive producer of the series American Experience had read a book called The Lobotomist by a journalist named Jack L. High. And it was also around the time there was a really moving NPR piece, a first-person account by a victim of lobotomy who had been lobotomized as a child. And he went out and searched. He kind of confronted his own father who had allowed this operation to happen. It was an incredible piece.
Yes.
Those two things happened at the same time, so there was kind of a synergy, and the exec producer suggested I look into this. And when I read this book, I mean, this guy just jumped off the page. It was just kind of a combination of a mad scientist, a brilliant mind, a kind of, you know, again, a well-motivated guy who had kind of fallen prey to his own ambition. There was so much in it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I, like everybody else, was sort of repelled by the idea of lobotomy, but, you know, also sort of weirdly fascinated by it. And the more I looked into it, you know, the more there was there. It really had legs, so we undertook it.
Well, we're talking about Walter Freeman, who was the physician that first embarked on this ice pick lobotomy. But tell me, you've spoken somewhat about him, but tell me a little bit more about his personality and what kind of drove him.
Right. Well, I'm sure everybody out there knows this type. He was, you know, he's a very brilliant man, but very cold. You know, he had a severe, you know, inability to emotionally connect, I think, with other human beings, and you could see that in his relationship with his family.
Right.
But he had a tremendous drive, both for personal success and for some kind of larger good to sort of help humanity. So he was very interested in helping humanity, but not so good about helping human beings. And that's a kind of lethal combination when you're talking about a doctor. You know, you have these people who feel like they're going to solve the problems of the world, but to do so, they're willing to, you know, create huge amounts of wreckage, you know, human wreckage around
mm-hmm.
them. And that's what this guy did.
He
just kind of, you know, he just kind of lost sight of what he was doing to people and really deluded himself more than anything else.
Forgive me if I'm wrong, but didn't he have a father who was also a physician? And
his grandfather was probably the most famous surgeon in America at the time when he was, you know, practicing.
Yeah.
So that kind of loomed over this guy's life.
Right.
It's really a classic character. I mean, that you'd find in, you know, the great classic literature. You know, the man that has that overwhelmed by ambition and it kind of blinds him in the end.
Totally. I mean, totally. You know, Kinsey was somewhat the same kind of guy. It's the sense that, you know, I can change the world by myself. I know better. What's really interesting about this story, partly what's really interesting about it is, yes, Freeman did these things, but medicine let him do these things. You know, what we were interested in looking at is how is it that this guy could go around with his ice pick, you know, damaging people's brains, and nobody seemed to stop him.
Mm, right.
So it was really a fascinating kind of look at how this whole thing worked back then with mental illness.
Well, tell me a little bit about, because I say the term ice pick lobotomy, transorbital, I think is another term for it.
Right.
Tell me what that actually entailed, the way, because it's so rustic in a way, it's difficult to believe.
It's kind of amazing. You know, basically what happened was he had been doing a different kind of lobotomy, one that was pioneered by a different doctor, but he was frustrated by how long it took to do. He could only do, you know, one every few hours. He wanted to bring this to the masses, and so he wanted to create a procedure that didn't require surgery. In essence, it required, you know, it was an outpatient procedure not to get too graphic, but, you know, he took an instrument that was literally an ice pick at first, but then an adapted thing that looked like an ice pick, and he went into the brain through the above the eye and with a hammer. It's the crudest thing you've ever seen. We had to decide whether or not how much of it to show, because he would film this. He had, you know, graphic films of this operation, and even other doctors fainted away at the sight of this thing. And as anesthetic, rather than regular anesthetic, what he would do is electroshock his patients into unconsciousness, and then he would perform this operation. It wasn't really even an operation. It was kind of a technique that no two were exactly the same, because he didn't even know what he was cutting in there. He just kind of moved it around, cutting things. But he had everybody snowed. I mean, he was so confident. He was so kind of technical about it, and he sort of presented his procedures so well that people were sort of believing it might work.
Yeah, and I could see where that would be absolutely necessary for him to be that, to approach it with that level of confidence. But it hadn't, there had been no tests, or it would be impossible to kind of test whether or not this would work before using it on a live patient.
That's right. I mean, you know, and in those days, this was, people today can't really believe the amount of power doctors had back then to just do whatever they wanted. This was before the era of double-blind tests and controlled experiments or anything like that. Mm-hmm. If a doctor in a white coat said it was going to help you, you generally believed it. And very few, there was very little supervision or kind of, you know, checks on that until much later in the 70s when lobotomy was finally kind of disgraced. So he, you know, his confidence, as you said, you know, just kind of plowed away all obstacles, and you know, there were enough successes, there was enough evidence, sketchy evidence, to support this procedure that people sort of said, you know what, we don't have any other alternative, these people are wasting away in institutions, let's try something.
Yeah, and not to say that it was entirely unsuccessful either, because there were some that their violent tendencies dissipated.
Exactly.
But the cost of it was they were largely lethargic. I mean, their humanity was tampered with in a way.
That's exactly it. And this is what's so fascinating about the story, because it is gray. It goes to the question of sort of what does it mean to be human, as someone in the film says. What is more important, the relief from this agony of mental illness,
right?
Or you know. This sort of lesser state of being human. It is a lesser state. People who had lobotomies, most of them lost their drive, lost their ability to reason, in some cases lost their judgment, but they weren't plagued by these, you know, horrible agony of mental illness. So that's why so many families accepted this, because it was seemed to be better than the alternative.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why I love your film in particular, because it's not afraid to kind of delve into these gray areas. I mean, we talked about the kind of the godlike stature of these physicians who are beyond reproach in a way. It discusses that. It discusses the conditions of the mental hospitals at that time, too.
Yeah.
And they were really, I think somebody compares them to concentration camps at one point in your film. They really were dumping grounds. We had no idea what to do with the mentally disturbed.
It was horrible, especially after World War II, when there were, you know, many returning GIs and who had been shell shocked. And yeah, there were people wandering around these horrible places, you know, naked and dirty, and you know, just not enough personnel to take care of them, and chained to their beds. It was the closest thing we've had to a concentration camp, and that was the necessary background for to understand how this could have unfolded the way it did.
Yeah. Yeah, and also speaks to our limited understanding of mental illness at that time.
Or now. We don't know. We don't understand it now. I mean, the psychopharmaceutical drugs that came in and actually really were the death knell of lobotomy, they were called the chemical lobotomy at the time, and they really basically are that. We don't really know why they work, if they work, how they work. Mental illness is still kind of baffling, and you know, we're not. That's a lesson I hope people draw from the film. We're not that far from this age. It's only 30 years ago that lobotomies were still being performed.
Yeah, we still have a lot to learn about the brain and how it functions, and how mental illness where that's located in the brain and what, you know, what kind of triggers those illnesses.
Absolutely. It's still completely mysterious, most of it. I mean, I don't think lobotomy could happen again. I think there are enough safeguards and ethical guidelines and oversight committees. But, you know, medicine is still going down blind alleys all the time, and
mm-hmm.
people have to be very careful about what they, you know, what they believe and what they, you know, what they're willing to try.
Well, and you've spoken to this too. I mean, we're on a similar path that could be just as dangerous, because we're medicating our children more and more. You know, and there's so much that we don't understand. We don't understand the full implications of how we're medicating ourselves and our children.
No question about it. I mean, I think, you know, mental illness is very scary to, you know, to just kind of, there, people feel they have to cure it. They have to try something. And you know, even though the magic pill is very tempting, you know, this will help me, this will alleviate the suffering, but we really don't have any idea about the long-term effects of these things when we're talking about children. We're going to see, we're going to find out, because some of these kids are going to be on it for 20, 30, 40, 50 years.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens.
Watching your film and discussing these themes, I also think about one of my favorite films, which is Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
And obviously lobotomies played a role in that, and as did shock therapy. What was the, kind of the tipping point that ended the practice of this type of lobotomy?
Well, you know, the medical profession would like people to believe that you know, Freeman was stopped by them, by far-seeing and kind of, you know, clear-eyed doctors. But the truth is that drugs came in. Thorazine was invented, and Thorazine was, you know, cheap. It didn't do permanent damage to the brain, but it was called a chemical lobotomy, and there was no longer any reason to do these crude ice pick procedures when you just could take a pill. And
right.
So Freeman was kind of lost his surgical privileges at all the hospitals he'd been operating in. He never admitted that lobotomy was, you know, what it was. He continued to kind of extol it as the great cure, and would kind of pathetically follow up with his patients, drive around the country getting testimonials from them, trying to prove to people that they were actually much better off, and trying to, you know, get kind of restore lobotomy's luster. But of course, it didn't work.
Well, and he was undeterred by failure. It was a big crusade for him. He had to be laser focused in a way. But it's covered in your film. Wasn't a big turning point that led kind of public opinion against his practice of lobotomy, didn't it involve one of the Kennedys?
Well, that you know, I mean, he lobotomized Rosemary Kennedy in the 50s, but it was very quiet. Her father, Joe Kennedy, was concerned about her behavior. This was a young woman who was probably not mentally ill, maybe slightly retarded, but was a behavioral issue. She wasn't playing by the rules. She would go out late at night. She was a wild girl, apparently. Not very much known about her. But Joe Kennedy had two sons who were potential presidents, and this young woman, Rosemary, was a threat to that future. And he called up Dr. Freeman. Dr. Freeman said, "Sure, I can take care of this problem." And you know, as far as we know, we would certainly know he lobotomized her, and we also know that she was terribly damaged, that she ended up needing full-time care for the rest of her life, disappeared into a convent home. But that wasn't known by the public. That isn't really what ended lobotomy. That only came out really fairly recently, in the last, you know, 15 years or so, that this had happened and that Rosemary had lived this way for most of her life. But there were other examples of disastrous results that did kind of, you know, hurt his reputation. In fact, the final blow was a patient who he had lobotomized for the third time and who died on the operating table. And that was really the final blow. He was then excommunicated from the medical profession, in essence, and no longer was able to do these things.
Yeah. What about, forgive me for not having knowledge of this, but I know that a similar debate reigned over the validity of shock therapy as well.
It did.
Has that been, what's the conclusion there?
That's a very different story, because actually shock therapy is now, has come back into favor, but in a much more narrow set of cases and used much more subtly and much more in a focused way. But apparently, you know, it does have positive effects, and doesn't have the lasting, you know, you call them side effects of lobotomy, which is, you know, permanent damage to your brain. So that was really very different. I mean, there was, you know, electroshock. There were many of these shock therapies, different kinds of things. They're all sort of horrible things. But electroshock is now being used again in very, very particular circumstances, and apparently it's very successful.
Yeah. It's a fascinating, very revealing documentary. I'm crazy about it. The last thing I want to ask you about was Campbell Scott.
Mm-hmm.
Does the narration for your film, and you've worked with him in the past. Tell me about that collaboration and how much of a collaboration it is, and what he lends to the project by narrating.
I've tried in my career to work with narrators who don't just have interesting voices, but who are, you know, intelligent people who can understand a line, understand what you're trying to do with it, understand the subtlety of it. And this guy's, you know, one of the best I've ever worked with. I worked with Andre Brouwer years ago, and he was absolutely marvelous.
Mm.
And I never thought I would find anybody else who had that kind of talent. And then, you know, working with Campbell, he's just as good. I mean, he's a guy who just immediately grasps what you're trying to do with your words. And, you know, we really care about the writing in these things, and I spend a lot of time on it. And to hand it over to someone to read, you want someone who's got the brain to really get it. And Campbell, I think, is just a great guy, smart, talented guy, and I'll use him as long as he's willing to be, you know, to collaborate with me. I'd be happy to collaborate with him.
Yeah, he is great, and he automatically just involves you.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's
great. He's got a voice where no matter what he says, it sounds interesting. That's the kind of voice I'd look for, you know.
Yeah.
I could be reading a phone book, and it would sound interesting.
Yeah. So how can my listeners view the movie? Is it currently on PBS?
It will be replayed on American Experience sometime during the season. I believe you can go on the website at pbs.org/American Experience and either view the full program or certainly part of the program. I don't know whether it's up and streaming yet completely, but in any case, they will definitely be rebroadcasting. You can also order them at PBS Video.
So they can be ordered for,
yes,
for DVD on that,
yes,
website.
Definitely.
Fantastic. I'm so sorry. I have a cold. I'm coughing here and there. I'm sorry about
that. No problem.
But thank you so much for coming on to our show and telling us about this new film.
Thank you for having me.
Is there something upcoming for you? Do you have something
in the works? I'm working on a film about the Lincoln assassination
for
American Experience, and about, you know, about John Wilkes Booth and his life and career. So it's very interesting stuff.
Now that is fascinating. Will you come back and talk to us about that?
I'd love to, anytime.
Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate you being on.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you
very much. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
A great film. Brett Goodman. The film is called The Lobotomist. And really, I mean, it's like the best documentaries where you're examining this guy and what he does, and in the process, so many other questions pop up, important questions. Like,
right,
you know, suffering, that's part of the human experience. And when you sever that from someone's brain, how much of their humanity have you just severed, you know?
Right, exactly.
It's so many questions and important questions to be explored in that movie. I urge everyone to look at pbs.org, find the next air date, or purchase the video. He's a great filmmaker and a great film. We have a good relationship with PBS. We're part of their American Experience series, and we're interviewing all of their filmmakers. And some great, just great material that they put out every season. So we're very thankful to them.
Right.
Good interview, Jerry.
It was an excellent interview. That was very good, very informative. And just talking about, like, the history of the doctor is, I can relate to a lot of that. My dad was a doctor, so I understand a lot where that's coming from.
It's a real classic character.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
it
someone
is.
whose ambition just eats him away.
Right.
Clouds his judgment.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, definitely see that film. It's called The Lobotomist. Okay, We're ready to close up shop, but we're going to finish this half hour here, replaying our interview with Joe Pantoliano from The Goonies, from The Sopranos, from countless films that we all love him in. His new film is called Canvas, and it just got released on DVD last week. It's available in all stores all over the country, and please pick it up. It's a great, heartwarming family film about a very important important topic, and that's schizophrenia, a very widely misunderstood topic. It seems like we're really dealing with the mental illness hour.
Yeah, really.
There's a common theme running around here.
Yes, it is.
But we're going to finish off the show replaying this interview. It was one of our highest profile interviews. It was a great honor to speak to both of them. And we will be back with you Sunday night for our big King of Kong filmmaker show, Pulitzer Prize winner David Auburn, and possibly another high-profile guest that we...
We have to be on our best behavior.
We really do. I mean, these are important people.
The guy wrote proof. We really got to be on our best behavior.
I know. It's not every day we talk to a Pulitzer Prize winner. I think he's younger than we are.
You're kidding.
I'm not for sure. I think he won it in his 20s. It's the first play, first high-profile play he wrote. Don't quote me on that, but I'll find out by Sunday. But, man, that's enough to make us feel like...
Oh, my God. Okay.
Talk about ambition eating us away.
I'm going to go have a bottle of wine.
thanks, everyone, for listening tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks, Eric, for calling in. It was a great conversation about summer movies.
Yes, it was.
And we appreciate everyone's support. Here's Joe Pantoliano and Joseph Greco. We will see you back here on Sunday.
Good night.
Canvas is the first feature film from writer-director Joseph Greco, and it tells the story of a family, played by Joe Pantoliano, Marcia Gay Harden, and young Devin Gearhart, who struggle to maintain a sense of normalcy in the face of schizophrenia. The film has received critical raves from the likes of John Anderson and Variety, who praises the picture's first-rate performances and uncompromising points of view. Canvas and is the first Shack, feature film from writer-director Joseph Greco. Usually is the first feature film from writer-director Joseph Greco. Let's get to the accolades that really tell the hard story of a family Devin Gearhart by Joe Pantoliano. Who's a struggle to a hard normal for Devin Gearhart. And the struggle film has received critical raves from the likes of Canvas, John Anderson, and the film has received critical raves from the likes of taken great performance of Canvas, like no other film and point of view. The first feature film from writer-director Joe Pantoliano. And tells the story of a family by Joe Greco and the film that are the accolades young Devin one of their greatest outpouring struggle to maintain the industry.
Okay, obviously a little technical difficulty there. I think it's a large file. I think I pressed play one too many times, so I'm going to press play. There'll be a brief pause because this is a sizable file while it uploads, and then it'll start playing, and I promise it'll just be one play. Here it goes, Canvas. Be just one moment.
Canvas is the first feature film from writer-director Joseph Greco, and it tells the story of a family, played by Joe Pantoliano, Marcia Gay Harden, and young Devin Gearhart, who struggle to maintain a sense of normalcy in the face of schizophrenia. The film has received critical raves from the likes of John Anderson and Variety, who praises the picture's first-rate performances and uncompromising point of view, and Frank Scheck from The Hollywood Reporter, who singles out the unusually sensitive approach to its subject. But let's get to the accolades that really count, the outpouring of praise from the thousands of audience members who have already witnessed the film in festivals across the country. To them, Canvas is more than a movie. It's something of a gift. And they have taken it into their hearts like no other film in recent memory. Tonight, we are honored to have the exceptionally talented writer-director of Canvas, Joseph Greco, and the film star and just one of the greatest actors on the planet, a tremendous treat for all of us, Mr. Joe Pantoliano. Joseph, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
And
hi, Joe.
Hey, Joey. Happy birthday, Joey.
Absolutely. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday. Thank you very much.
We can't thank you both enough for joining us tonight. It's a great pleasure. I had the pleasure of seeing this movie earlier this year at the Sarasota Film Festival, and I have never seen an audience reaction like it. People were just so incredibly moved by this film, and they really took it into their hearts. And
yeah, well, enough about you. What do you think of me?
You
were—that's an old joke. I had to use it.
You were remarkable, but we'll save that for a little bit later. Mr. Greco, I wanted to ask you first. This is your first feature film, and when you sat down to write this, it looks like you followed what they say is one of the first rules: you to write what you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I set out to make this movie some time ago after graduating film school and actually worked as an assistant to James Cameron during Titanic, which is when I actually first started putting pen to paper. Mm-hmm. But it took a while to get off the ground, and I think that was actually a good thing, because that long gestation period, I think, gave me a lot of objectivity. But, it's what's been really interesting and what's been great about working with Joey is that, I tend to approach, directing just from the standpoint of trying to create the most honest moments I can. And when you have great actors, you're always getting great ideas. So the script was evolving even through production. Joey and I, Joey, in addition to starring in the movie, is also a producer. So we did a lot of work before he came down to Florida to shoot the movie. And, it was a really great collaboration. So I think, and in fact, a couple of the best lines of the movie, I wish I could take credit for, but I can't. Joey, which, I appreciate what you guys are saying, and it's been really amazing, the journey, just making this film and now seeing the audiences really take to it is quite wonderful.
It is amazing, and it seems that everyone's responding to a real sense of truth and authenticity from the...
Yeah, the thing about, and Joey will talk about this, I'm sure, is, he and Marcia both went out of their way to make sure that their portrayals were really on the mark,
uh-huh.
and they spent time with people in the mental health community doing their research, and the thing that I love, one of the things that's most gratifying is that people, not just people in the mental health community, not just the doctors, but critics are saying it's in their opinions the most accurate portrayal of schizophrenia that they've ever seen in movies, which is a testament to Marcia. I mean, she's just phenomenal, and there's no one else who could have pulled off the part.
Absolutely.
Thank you for that.
Mr. Pantoliano, was it that sense of truth and authenticity, was that one of the things that stuck out for you when you first read the script?
Actually, I've thought selfishly that it was a great opportunity for me to play a role where I was a caregiver and victimized, by this illness. I see this movie more a movie about what happens to a family
who has when mental illness is brought into the fold. You know, Joe's was born to a schizophrenic mom, and his whole life was that. And we thought, Joe and I and Marcia included, thought that it would be better for Mary's illness to come around age 4 or 5 years old, so that Christopher had a memory, the same memory that the father and the son shared in the memory of their mother being whole and the caregiver and making dinner and working, and so that when that element stopped, both he and I started to unravel in our own way. And then the saving grace in the movie, besides the help that she's able to get and the understanding, just like any kind of addiction, when she's willing to accept that there is something wrong, that she admits that there is something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but it's through the three points of art, you know, canvas, heat, designing shirts, and me building, you know, an arc, so to speak, in my driveway, and her with a painting.
I'm glad you brought that up, because another thing that it deals with are the healing powers of the creative arts.
That's right.
Not to mention, you know, not to mention that in terms of suffering, I mean, the occupational hazards that if you look, you point out a great artist, past or present, and tell me that, show me one that wasn't suffering from some form of pain, from Hemingway to Van Gogh to you know, Brando. Pick somebody that's brilliant. Look at the Renaissance. I mean, you know, 1,000 years of creativity, and then, you know, you got Switzerland, where it was 500 years of peace, and all they produced was a cuckoo clock.
Ah, the third man.
That's right. Orson Welles. And yeah, Orson Welles. There you go, another guy.
Yeah.
You know, so the occupational hazards of, you know, of when we, you know, when you go into acting school, they tell you to be childlike, to embrace that quality, to be inventive, to have vivid imagination, you know, to nourish your imagination.
Yeah.
And my imagination gets me in trouble. I mean, I doing this movie was simply selfish on my part. I wanted to get as far away from the Ralph Cifaretto character as possible. Going through the journey of it, you know, I saw more of my mother and Marcia's character.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I screened it at Penn State at my daughter's school. And, you know, Joe will tell you, we've gone to a lot of these screenings. So, you know, I get tired of watching the movie. But at this point, at Penn State 4 months ago, I did watch it again for the first time. And I realized, having seen it more, maybe 4 or 5 times, that I was portraying my father in that movie, because my father would sell us kids, he'd sell us out only to make peace. No matter what it was, he would always surrender to my mother's, you know, crazy episodes, just to calm her down, whatever it would take.
Right.
And that's when I started having to, you know, deal with understanding that my mother's, you know, screaming for her tranquilizers and, you know, punching herself in the face, you know, scratching her face till it bled. I just thought that was normal, that everybody's mom was like that.
Well, you're remarkable in this film. But I think it's safe to say that you're known for some of your more morally questionable characters.
They're fallible. I mean, it's like, it's so easy to say, to, you know, when people say, oh yeah, you were the bad guy in The Matrix. What that guy had to do, what Judas, you know, Judas was Jesus, was one of Jesus's most faithful, and then in selling him out, you know, was destroyed.
Yeah.
He destroyed himself once he did it. You know, he was so flawed. But, you know, when you, the guy in The Matrix who gets the opportunity to, you know, killing the people that he loved and then having no memory of it, mm-hmm. and then getting to come back as a movie star, I do that to Joe Greco right now.
Are there particular challenges to playing a regular family man?
I don't know. You know, there was nothing regular about this guy because he's, you know, he was on a sinking ship. I mean, the metaphors that Joe created, you know, with building a ship and with building an ark and going back to the real Florida. I mean, everybody really wants what Mary verbalizes. Mary says, I want to go back to the real Florida. Well, that was the Florida that we all remember and loved. And all of us really want to go back to the real Florida, but we don't know how to get there. And, you know, what I like about this movie is that there is no magic pill. You know, there is no, you know, romanticism of a dreaded disease that I thought was a minority illness until I got more and more involved in the movie. And, you know, and now we're being embraced by all groups. And kids love this movie. My daughter, my teenage daughter, my college daughter, my 9-year-old, they all love this movie because of these kids.
Mm-hmm.
That are in it, you know. It's really a love story. I mean, the movie's a love story about a problem that occurs in the family, and nobody gives up on Mary.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's an unconditional love, really. I mean, that's.
You know, I don't have that in my life. Unconditional love. The only ones that love me unconditionally in my household are my four dogs. You know, there's all other kinds of conditions. I come home, they come running out, they're wagging their tail, they really don't want anything.
No, Joey, Joey's got a great family, and, you know, when I met Joey for the first time, you know, I hadn't, you know, all I saw were most of the films that you guys are mentioning, the films where he's, you know, playing the amoral character. But when I met, I immediately felt comfortable and recognized a lot of qualities that my father had, you know, and has. You know, my father's a great loving man and an Italian-American father who says more oftentimes by what he doesn't say,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense. And
yeah.
And that's really why I felt Joey was right for this. And there's I think in some of the scenes in the film that I love the most, you almost expect Joey's character to whack one of the other characters. You know, there's like this, you know, and that kind of edge I thought was really good for the movie, and that complexity, you know, I thought was really appropriate, you know.
Well, they're always threatened. They're always on the verge of kind of just a breakdown. And
I think
all families, whatever situation they're in, can relate to that.
Yeah, and because there's a scene where Joey's character gets—I mean, I don't want to give away too much here—but basically, the family goes through hell.
Yeah.
And the guy loses his job, and you know, there's a moment where you think that Joey's character is gonna, you know, hit his boss, like, what the hell are you doing here? But but all the characters, you know, the kids and Joey, there's a crossroads. There's a point where we could all either act out negatively from something that happens in our lives, or act out positively and sublimate what happens into a positive outlet. And mm-hmm. and I think that's also what I think the movie's about. You know, Marcia certainly is using art, but also Joe. You know, Joey's character. You know, John. What he's built. He's trying to hold on to his life. And if he didn't have, and I think everyone wants to connect with something or someone. And if they can't connect, you know. John can't connect with his wife, so he's going to connect with this boat. The kid, you know, he's using art. You know, he's putting himself into or using the artistic outlet to cope.
Yeah, but out of a necessity, I mean,
he
becomes
he
a breadwinner.
He could just as easily turn negative. You know, he could have been, you know, turned to drug. I mean, we've seen that story, though, you know, and I, you know, wanted to tell a story where there's a positive way to get through it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, Joey, what were you going to say? Go ahead.
No, that I've learned so much having done this movie, that my life is really, I'm in a much better place today than I was 2 years ago when I started working on this movie. You know, emotionally, I'm grateful for all that I've learned, all that I know, and, you know, it was a very, very hard experience making that movie. I had, you know, all of these wonderful producing partners that had never produced a movie before. But, you know, they put their own money out. They begged, borrowed, and steal. And we were able to make this movie, and, you know, without killing each other, really.
Well, I know that you talk about how meaningful this journey has been with this film, Mr. Pantoliano. You've started, actually, a No Kidding Me Too society.
Yeah, it's a 501c nonprofit to take on stigma and to destigmatize mental illness and the de-isolation that goes along with. When Mary is diagnosed with schizophrenia, the relatives don't want her over the house because they're afraid that she's going to, you know, maybe bite the family dog. Mm. And, you know, I'm co-president of the Creative Coalition with Tony Goldwyn, and we take on matters of the art that are nonpartisan issues. And I think mental illness, well, I know for a fact that that's the most nonpartisan disease I know.
Mm.
So what we want to do is to reach out and raise awareness because it's more common than one would think. I had no idea that 2 in 5 Americans suffer from some form of mental illness, or if anybody's diagnosed, or if a child is born with autism, that illness is going to affect 11 immediate members in the family. You know, 4 in 6 Americans have someone in their life that they know or love that is suffering from some form of mental illness. And, you know, this is a movie that deals with, you know, bipolar disorder, depression, schizophrenia.
It's more widespread than anyone realizes.
And what we're finding out is that, you know, a lot of folks that are going into rehab with alcohol addiction or drug addiction is really self-medication from what is simply, you know, depression or bipolar disorder.
Right.
Because before I met Joe Greco, I thought that schizophrenia meant that you had multiple personalities, that you saw things, that you heard things, that, you know, it's so sophisticated. And you know, I thought that electroshock therapy was a horrible, torturous way to deal with a person because of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But in fact, you know, we find out now, Joe and I went to this NAMI convention where they honored us with the Best Picture Award, but Kitty Dukakis was there, and she gets electroshock. Over 100,000 people get it. It's the most benign and most successful form of therapy for depression.
Hmm.
Wow, I did not know that.
Wow.
I had no idea.
Well, Mr. Greco, I know that this project is so personal for you, and you're a Florida State graduate, and you chose to shoot the film in your hometown of Hollywood, Florida, which is right near my neck of the woods, actually. I'm a Florida boy as well.
Oh, yeah? Where?
I'm in Lakeland, which is between...
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah,
I know where that is.
I'm in that little patch of land right there. Was that an important decision for you? To shoot in the comfort zone?
Yeah, I mean, I'm so appreciative that the producers and the cast supported me on that decision. I mean, initially, you know, it's my first feature, so I'm so excited to have the opportunity to make the film. And Joey and Marcia, being from New York, I actually entertained the idea of going to New York and shoot it there. And you know, Marcia had just had her twins, and so I knew it would be much easier for her if I shot in Jersey. And as luck would have it, the timing was such that we had to shoot this in October, and the money and the investors and the producers were all pretty adamant that we shoot in Florida because it was actually going to be cheaper. And thank God, you know, everyone agreed, you know, and Marcia and Joey were like, okay, fine. But the funny thing was, Joey said to me, well, you got to shoot in October if we're going to do this. I said, well, Joey, that's it's still hurricane season. I, you know, can we do it a little later? No, you got to do it in October. I got other movies going on. You got to do it in October. And so when Joey Pants says you got to shoot in October, you shoot in
do
October.
It, yeah.
So, you know, Hollywood, Florida, where I grew up, hadn't been hit by a hurricane in over 40 years. I thought, hey, what the hell? So,
oh, my.
We, actually got hit by Hurricane Katrina, outer bands of Katrina, before it went on to devastate New Orleans. Then we got hit by Rita. And this is all in pre-production prep. You know, we're about 2 months out. And then our third week of shooting, and we're doing this movie on you know, a shoestring to begin with. So our third week of shooting, Hurricane Wilma comes and hits us directly, and on my mother's birthday, ironically.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, it shut us down for 4 days. We almost didn't finish the film. And Marcia and Joey and the little boy, we sent them out of town because we didn't want them to be in Florida when the thing hit.
Yeah.
And they came back knowing full well that the hotel had nothing but candlelight and no air conditioning, and they had to fly into Orlando, which is 4 hours outside of Hollywood, and drive down because the airports were closed.
We couldn't get in our rooms because the electricity was out. You know, the electric stick on your card.
Yeah.
Like, you know, your valuables are in that little safe, that electronic safe, so you can't get any of that out. You know, and Devin was selling lemonade to help pay for the food for the cast and crew.
I don't know if it was that bad, but it was close.
Hey, well, that's Florida for you. And probably, I would think, if you picked up anything from working as an assistant to James Cameron during Titanic, it taught you that you can overcome those stumbles.
Yeah, well, you know what?
Well,
James
Cameron had $250 million to overcome it.
That's true.
Yeah, well, you know, but it's funny you should say that, because I kept thinking that to myself. It's not as bad as Titanic. And it, you know, and it was...
Yeah, at least the Titanic had a band.
Yeah, but you know, I gotta tell you, I mean, looking back, it was hell. But I had an amazing cast. The crew was unbelievable, and the producers, everybody, just it was a labor of love. You know, and I think, you know, they were able to get gas. They were able to have a hot meal when they couldn't, you know, at home. So it was. We were this little oasis where people could come and actually continue working when most of the city was just devastated.
Yeah,
and
the movie is made out of love, and you absolutely feel that. And I think that's what's affecting audiences. And you know, films like these are sadly more and more rare in today's theatrical climate. So everyone just owes it to themselves to go see this film. It's amazing. Before I let you guys go, I have to ask you, Mr. Pantoliano. You know, you've got over 120 amazing credits to your name, and you've worked with Spielberg and De Niro and all these classic films, but I'm willing to bet that when the average person approaches you on the street nowadays, it's got to be all about Frankie Cefarelli and The Sopranos, am I right?
Well, it depends, you know. I'm shooting a movie right now in Spokane, and it's been more Bad Boys in the Matrix.
I see that.
You know,
yeah.
I was shooting up. I was working just recently in New Mexico, and there's a lot of colleges there, so it was more Memento. You know, like on Memento, and as far as Ralph Cifaretto, I get that a lot in, like, the New England tri-state area.
Okay. That was such a dynamic series. But that the conclusion of that series was perfect, right? I mean,
I thought it was awesome.
Yeah. It was one of those conclusions where at first I didn't quite get it, and I've heard this from so many other people, but... And when you reflect on it, it makes more and more sense to you. And it was just a perfect way to end that show, just a wonderful show.
Yeah, and I think that David, you know, the idea that there was that bleep of darkness where everybody thought, what the fuck, my television, you know? I don't think I can say the F word, can I?
You can say whatever you'd like.
You can say whatever you like.
So you automatically remember where you were, right? You're gonna always remember where you were, but I think it's all there. And at the end of the day, it's like Tony is going to have to, and that family will be looking over their shoulder, and it might be for the next 30 seconds, or it might be for the next 30 years. But it's
right.
What a way to live a life.
It was perfect. Yeah. So the film opens in major cities on the 12th of October, is that correct?
And the following week is Los Angeles.
The 19th. So the 12th, New York, Chicago, and then the 19th, it opens another city. So.
And what cities are those, Joe? It's Los Angeles, Arizona.
Let's see, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Phoenix, Fort Lauderdale, and there's a few others, I think, that are
Michigan.
Whittier, Connecticut, Portland, I think Grand Rapids.
That's right, Wilton Theater. Yeah, Wilton, the Bowtie Theater in Wilton, Connecticut, where I will be doing Q&As all weekend long.
Oh, wow. And wow. Is that on the 19th or the 12th?
That's the weekend of the 12th.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Well, I urge everyone to go out and see.
Oh, one more thing, if you wouldn't mind. Please ask your listeners to go to canvasthefilm.com.
Yes.
And they can put their email address and get alerts. So as the movie builds an audience, we'll be going to other theaters, and we'll be letting them know that.
Okay.
Cool.
Absolutely. Right. We have links for those sites on our pages as well. So, gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us tonight. It's been an honor to speak to both of you. And,
thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Best of luck on the film.
Thanks,
guys.
Thanks again.
We appreciate it. Great show, and we'll talk soon. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.